Hi, this is Vivek Kumar Hin, BA Part 2, Faculty of Social Sciences. Now, this is the theme of Far From the Madding Crowd. The novel Far From the Madding Crowd is a tragic comedy. Its title is ironical. The title of the novel is taken from Gray's Elegy written in a country churchyard. Far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, their sober vices never learn to stray. Along the cool, sequestered well of life, they kept the noiseless tenor of their way. But it is not the noiseless tenor of the country forefathers that is treated in the novel. In one way, the extract from the Elegy conforms to the spirit of the novel. It is in the novel that the Wessex country and characters are introduced to the public for the first time. Cyril Aldred, commenting on the theme of the novel, says, "Hardy seems as exuberant as a Miranda in the undue new world which has such creatures in it. Characters and settings, as in so many of the Wessex novels, are in perfect sympathy. The presence of Gabriel Oak is reflected in the quiet landscape, and the crisis of Bathsheba's relations with Troy is marked by a crisis in nature, the great storm. The story progresses with a slow country rhythm which is Virgilian in its pastoral leisure. It is the morning of Hardy's art. As yet, the noonday thunder clouds do not menace the horizon. Although the novel has got a happy ending, Bathsheba is married to Gabriel Oak, but the various characters have gone through tragic circumstances. Bathsheba marries the worthless soldier Troy, but soon she discovers that he has had other affairs with another woman, who has just died after having given birth to his baby. Troy leaves Bathsheba, and she begins to love Boldwood. On the day of their marriage, Troy appears dead drunk. Boldwood shoots him. He is tried and sentenced to life imprisonment. Bathsheba is prostrate with grief and gradually comes to realize that she had erred long before in not accepting the faithful Gabriel. When Gabriel decides to leave the vicinity, she comes to his cottage and offers herself in marriage. Thus the tragedy is changed into comedy. The vain and beautiful Bathsheba at last finds contentment and peace with the man she had at first considered commonplace and unattractive. The distinguishing characteristic of the story, however, is that it has many facets, joys and sadness, action and description flash past in turn. There are echoes in the treatment of Fanny Robin, which remind us that Dickens had died 4 years before the novel was written. Shakespeare is another writer who is inevitably recalled, especially in the dialogue of the rustics. The self-assured bottom can be heard in the boasting words of Henry. Hardy had succeeded in combining pastoral richness with furious passion and thwarted purpose. Commenting on the theme of the novel, Barker says, "Far from the madding crowd, 1874, breathes irony in its very title. It is the tragic comedy of rural life, pathos mingling with its opposite and settling at last into a measure of chastened happiness for the principal characters with the main stress, however, on the furious passions, thwarted purposes and shattering griefs which are the reality behind the idyllic calm of the pastoral scene." The pictorial method of narration, which was to prove so apt at conveying Hardy's sense that the particular drama envisaged was part of the general human drama, nay, of the drama in which are implicated all things that breathe and all this is part of the mighty drama of the universe, is now fully developed. The natural scenery is no more setting, but an integral element, human activity being thus shown in the grip of the vaster forces, a life within a greater life, part of the infinite. Far from the madding crowd symbolizes Hardy's desire for painting the life of poor peasants in the Wessex countryside. He explained his new approach to the countryside in an article published in the Forum in 1888. He prefers the bucolic life to the life of the madding crowd in big cities. Commenting on this point and pointing out the general drift of the early novels of Hardy, including Far from the Madding Crowd, Wilbur L. Cross says, "The conduct of the upper classes is screened by conventions and thus the real character is not easily seen, and if it is seen, it must be portrayed subjectively, whereas in the lower walks, conduct is a direct of the inner life, and thus character can be directly portrayed through the act. In one case, the author's word has to be taken as to the nerves and muscles of his figures. In the other, they can be seen as in an ecorque. From their views on the question of style, the naturalists fall in two classes. There are the extremists who, like Aristotle, the practical realist of antiquity, let style look out for itself on the ground that any attention to it would result in a rhetorical misrepresentation of fact. And there are the poets who clothe the disagreeable narrative in the most pleasing language of command. To the latter class, Hardy has the most affinity. The choice of words and the arrangement of them in and for themselves he does not believe in. His aim is at an exact and felicitous expression of his ideas and emotions, and the first principle he lays down to this end is the lucid order of Horace. Style in this high sense, he would do his little towards bringing to ultimate perfection when completed the novel should give on account of the subject matter and its treatment an aesthetic pleasure similar to that derived from a fine painting. It is exactly true of Far From the Madding Crowd. It is wonderful painting of the landscape of Wessex. Hardy has laid down the foundation of his art in this novel. The fatalistic view of life, the play of circumstances and incidents, the role of irony in human life are so well combined that Far From the Madding Crowd becomes the harbinger of great novels. The Return of the Native and Tests of D'Urbervilliers. It is in this novel that Hardy strikes a new note of new realism. The novel shows a defiant spirit of revolt against the library fashions of the age. It is the beginning of the original novel known as the Wessex novel. The word Wessex is introduced for the first time in the novel. Wessex is that part of England which includes Dorset and other countries to the north and west of it. The whole of the area has been pictorially described in this novel. The powers of the pictorial art of Hardy have come into full play. The novel is full of the most pictorial descriptions, one of which is the description of Norcombe Hill in the beginning of the novel. The hill was covered on its northern side by an ancient and decaying plantation of beeches, whose upper words formed a line over the crest, fringing its arched curve against the sky like a mane. Tonight, these trees sheltered the southern slope from the keenest blasts, which smote the wood and floundered through it with a sound as of gambling or gust over its crowning boughs in a weekend moan. The dry leaves in the ditch simmered and boiled in the same breeze, a tongue of air occasionally ferreting out a few and sending them spinning across the grass. A group or two of the latest in date amongst the dead multitude had remained till this very midwinter time on the twigs which bore them, and in falling rattled against the trunks with smart taps. The sky was clear, remarkably clear, and the twinkling of all the stars seemed to be but throbs of one body, timed by a common pulse. The North Star was directly in the wind's eye, and since evening the bier had swung round it outwardly to the east, till he was now at a right angle with the meridian, a difference of colour in the stars, oftener read of than seen in England, was really perceptible here. The sovereign brilliancy of Sirius pierced the eye with a steely glitter. The star called Capella was yellow. Aldebaran and Beclerquex shone with a fiery red. Two persons standing alone on a hill during a clear midnight such as this, the roll of the world eastward is almost a palpable movement. The sensation may be caused by the panoramic glide of the stars past earthly objects, which is perceptible in few minutes of stillness, or by the better outlook upon space that a hill affords, or by the wind, or by the solitude. But whatever be its origin, the impression of riding along is vivid and abiding. The poetry of motion is a phrase much in use, and to enjoy the epic form of that gratification, it is necessary to stand on a hill at a small hour of the night, and having first expanded with a sense of difference from the mass of civilized mankind, who are dream-wrapped and disregardful of all such proceedings at this time, long and quickly watch your stately progress through the stars. The paragraph is an example of one of the great pictorial evocations of the face of nature. The beauty of such passages is that they are at once local and universal. The local in Far From the Madding Crowd merges into the universal. Baker, commenting on the point, says, "The stage in far from the madding crowd, is not limited to the little corner of Wessex, but is boundless, that in these localized passions and conflicts, man is to be seen fighting with destiny, and that the music rustic protagonists are no humbler or less worthy of regard than the heroes and monarchs of more grandiose tragedy. Far from the madding crowd begins a new chapter in the career of Hardy. His philosophy, his art of characterization, and his delineation of the rustic life of Wessex all impart a unique place to the novel. William Rutland points out the essential theme and features of the novel in these admirable words. In Far from the Madding Crowd, Hardy has come almost to his full stature. The sphere of experiment has been left behind. Not only does he know what he wishes to do, he has the technique at command with which to do it. The humor of the Wessex rustic is probably at its best in these pages. The descriptions, the opening chapter, the sheep shearing, Gabriel Oak thatching, the reeks before the storm are worthy to stand beside any that Hardy was to write. Bathsheba is that very characteristic compound called by critics the Hardy women. But Boldwood, who has strangely no Christian name, is too much of a lay figure. The character of Gabriel Oak, on the other hand, is an achievement. The strong, simple, and lovable shepherd is one of the most memorable figures in the Wessex novels. The happy ending is a concession, but even the return of the native ends with such a concession. If a final sound of wedding bells can be called a happy ending when it comes after such a breaking of hearts, that the peace of the grave is welcome. In Far from the Madding Crowd, tragedy stops short of the intensity which the latter novels achieve. Indeed, there is more pathos than real tragedy. The whole Boldwood episode is too artificial to grip the heart, but the episode of Fanny Robin does. It was the development of the manner in which the 40th chapter is written that was to give us the will of Michael Henchard and the baptism of Tess Sorrow. But Far from the Madding Crowd does not sear as Tess Sears or the Mayor of Casterbridge. Moreover, it will lack that power so memorably put forth in the return of the native, of enveloping the mere plot in an atmosphere more potent than any single incident. It is, in short, a work everywhere shows the highest, but not yet, except perhaps occasionally in its comedy, genius. Such a novel should be highly popular, and popular Far from the Madding Crowd certainly was. It made Hardy's name as a novelist and so paved the way for greater things to come. Now we will talk the genesis of the novel. The book, The Life and Letters of Leslie Stephen, was written by F. W. Maitland. In 1906, Hardy contributed some chapters to this book as well as a poem called Shreckhorn. In the contributory pages of the book, Hardy writes, "It was at the beginning of December 1872, on a wet and windy morning, when in a remote part of the country, that a letter stained with raindrops arrived for me in a handwriting so fine that it might have been traced with a pinpoint. This letter was from Stephen. Hardy negotiated with him for the publication of the novel. Stephen agreed to publish the novel in Cornhill magazine without having read it. After returning from Cromwell on the last day of December 1873, Hardy purchased at Plymouth a copy of Cornhill and, to his great surprise, saw his novel published in beginning of the issue of the magazine. The name of the author of the novel, which came out serially in the succeeding issues, was kept anonymous. There was large-scale guesswork about the authorship of the novel, and the Spectator in 1874 hazarded a guess that it might be written by George Eliot. When the novel was published in one volume, it was again surmised that its author might be George Eliot. The novel was given a very rousing reception. Leslie Stephen paid a rich tribute to Hardy in the following words: "I am to congratulate you on the reception of your first member. Besides the gentle Spectator, which thinks that you must be George Eliot because you know the name of stars, several good judges have spoken to me warmly of the Madding Crowd. Moreover, the Spectator, though flighty off in its head, has really a good deal of critical feeling. I always like to be praised by it, and indeed by other people. The story comes out very well, I think, and I have no criticism to make." The novel established his reputation. The first contribution of this novel was the settlement of marriage between Hardy and Emma Lavinia Gifford. She was at that time 29. Being courageous, beautiful, and able, she attracted Hardy. She read the novels of Hardy and encouraged him to write with vigor, far from the madding crowd. After the great popularity and success of this novel, they were married at St. Peter's Church. Far from the madding crowd was copiously reviewed in all the library periodicals, and most of the reviews were quite valedictory. When most of the critics attributed this novel to George Eliot on account of its striking resemblances with the novels of George Eliot, Hardy expressed surprise at this guess and expressed his views on this comparison in the following words. Why, he could never understand, since so far as he had read that great thinker, one of the greatest living, he thought, though not a born storyteller by any means, she had never touched the life of the fields. Her country people having seemed to him too more like small townsfolk than rustics, and as evidencing a woman's wit cast in country dialogue rather than real country humor, which he regarded as rather of Shakespeare and Fielding sort. However, he conjectured as a possible reason for the flattering guess that he had latterly been reading Comte's Positive Philosophy and writings of that school, some of whose expressions had thus passed into his vocabulary expressions, which were also common to George Eliot. As a matter of fact, the critics were guided in their guess to attribute Far from the Madding Crowd to George Eliot by the similarity between the style and phraseology. The Times critic wrote, almost from the first page to the last, the reader is never quite free from a suspicion that Mr. Hardy is consciously or unconsciously imitating George Eliot's phraseology and style of dealing with the rough material of words. There were other resemblances too. For example, the descriptions of scene in Meal on the Floss were similar to those in Far from the Madding Crowd. Whatever the resemblances with George Eliot, Hardy's reputation as a leading novelist was firmly established. The novel attracted attention of the foreigners. A German translation was soon asked for. Till then, Hardy had not been popular in Germany, hence the translation was a tribute to his genre. But Hardy was profoundly appreciated in France. Almost all his novels had been translated into French. And at the time of his death, France showed utmost reverence to his memory. The France Academy voted an address of sympathy to the English nation. Many interesting and scholarly articles were written on the appreciation of Far from the Madding Crowd. Then, the outline summary of the novel. The plot is laid among the shepherds and small farmers of the village of Weatherbury. Far from the Madding Crowd's ignoble strife, Hardy himself explains the situation of the village in the preface to the novel. Moreover, the village called Weatherbury, wherein the scenes of the present story of the series are, for the most part, laid, would perhaps be hardly discernible by the explorer without help in any existing place nowadays. Though at the time, comparatively recent at which the tale was written, a sufficient reality to meet the descriptions both of backgrounds and personages might have been traced easily enough. Bathsheba Everdeen is a poor girl who comes to the village of Weatherbury with household goods in a wagon. Gabriel Oak, a bachelor and a farmer, notices the beautiful maid at the turnpike gate where the wagon stops for the payment of taxes. There is higgling over 2 pence. The farmer Oak pays 2 pence to the gatekeeper and the wagon is allowed to pass. Bathsheba does not speak a word. She looks at farmer Oak with little indifference. Gabriel finds Bathsheba full of vanity, but the farmer is full of romantic love for her. Oak meets Bathsheba again while she is riding a horse and performing some feat of bodily exercise. At first, the girl is thrilled at the idea of having a piano and the other small comforts which Gabriel can provide, but she finally decides that she will be bored with married life. One night, Gabriel loses his flock of sheep because a dog had become excited and had driven them over a cliff. From this loss, he soon loses his entire farm and is forced to travel about seeking employment elsewhere. Meanwhile, Bathsheba has inherited a farm in the vicinity from her uncle. One night, her barn catches fire, and the man who rushes from the road to help put out the flames is Gabriel. He becomes her hired man. Bathsheba's beauty and prosperity attracted many suitors, among whom was the aristocratic William Boldwood. But suddenly, the gay young blade sergeant Troy comes upon the scene, and Bathsheba is swept off her feet. Even at their wedding supper, when Sergeant Troy becomes hopelessly drunk, Bathsheba realizes that she has made a poor choice. Gabriel Oak has watched the suitors come and go, and even after the object of his love has married the worthless soldier, he continues to work patiently for his mistress. Bathsheba gradually learns that Sergeant Troy has had other affairs, and one girl had just died after having given birth to his baby. Finally, Troy leaves Bathsheba and the farm. A report is circulated that he had been drowned. William Boldwood enters the scene again, and Bathsheba promises to marry him at the end of 7 years, when Troy would be legally declared dead and she would be free to marry. At a Christian Eve party to celebrate the decision, Troy suddenly appears dead drunk. Boldwood shoots him. He is tried and sentenced to life imprisonment. Bathsheba is prostrate with grief and gradually comes to realize that she had erred long before in not accepting the faithful Gabriel. When Gabriel decides to leave the vicinity, she comes to his cottage and offers herself to him in marriage. The vain and beautiful Bathsheba at last finds contentment and peace with the man she had at first considered commonplace and unattractive. Now we will talk about the element of the melodrama in the plot. As we read the novel, we come across certain sensational and violent scenes and episodes which make the novel melodramatic. In this respect, the novel bears close resemblance with Great Expectations of Charles Dickens. Miss Havisham's events of life as described are melodramatic. Similarly, the life of Fanny as described by Hardy is melodramatic. It is necessary to understand the full import of the word melodrama. Before we can understand the melodramatic events in the novel, it is a play which employs startling and sensational action and lurid, emotional and exaggerated language in order to play upon the emotional and sentimental reactions of the audience. Integration of plot, character development, or dramatic motivation are definitely secondary to the exaggerated accidents of the action, designed to inspire horror, joy, deep feelings of pity and sorrow. This type of work is usually full of hairbreadth escapes, oppressive villains, noble heroes and sorrowing families, who are rescued usually in the nick of time, with all ending happily for the good pupil and sadly for the bad individuals. The term melodramatic may be applied to any form of writing in which the sensational and the spectacular predominate. In Far From the Madding Crowd, we have love affair between Fanny and Troy, the events of which are melodramatic. Commenting on the melodramatic element in Far From the Madding Crowd, Baker says, "In the present case, Hardy's straining after uncommon brings in some melodrama. This appears in the character and the doings of Sergeant Troy, that disturber of the peace, and in Farmer Boldwood, whose personal tragedy is dragged in to clear the air, dissipate illusions, and prepare the harmonious union of Oak and Bathsheba. The tragic catharsis is turned to the benefit of others. Boldwood has the traditional calm, self-disciplined nature, stung to infatuation by a woman's capricious blandishments. Troy, the rake, in a military tunic, selfish and cynical, though not quite unfeeling, a triple disturbance, and irresistibly debonair. Troy is an emissary of the general malevolence. When Bathsheba gives in to his easy flatteries, the careless sergeant smiled within himself, and probably see the devil smiled from a loophole in Tophet. For the moment was the turning point of a career, and when long supposed drowned, he returns to confound Boldwood's chance of happiness on the very point of fulfillment. He appears as the impersonator of heaven's persistent irony towards him, who had once before broken in upon his bliss, scourged him, and snatched his delight away. There are three incidents in the novel which the critics have declared as melodramatic. First is the journey of Fanny from Weatherbury to Casterbridge that ultimately results in her death. The second is the tragic bathing of Troy, but his miraculous escape from death, and third is the shooting of Troy by Boldwood. These major incidents are not essentially melodramatic. The death of Fanny due to unbearable fatigue is something natural and realistic. If the affairs of Troy and Fanny are like a subplot, and the subplot is well integrated into the main plot by the conjugal relations between Bathsheba and Troy, it doesn't have that much of violence, excitement and blood which may place it in the category of melodrama. The second is the fatal bathing of Troy. This incident too is probable. It doesn't touch the sense of improbability in us. The shooting of Troy by Boldwood is another melodramatic incident. In the novel, the exciting and sensational element has been described by the novelist in the chapter 3 in the following words. In bewilderment, they turned their eyes to Boldwood. At his back, as he stood before the fireplace, was a gun rack, as is usual in farmhouses, constructed to hold two guns. When Bathsheba had cried out in her husband's grasp, Boldwood's face of gnashing despair had changed. The veins had swollen, and a frenzied look had gleamed in his eye. He had turned quickly, taken one of the guns, cocked it, and at once discharged it at Troy. Troy fell. The distance apart of the two men was so small that the charge of shot did not spread in the least, but passed like a bullet into his body. He uttered a long guttural sing. There was a contraction and extension, then his muscles relaxed and he lay still. Boldwood wanted to kill himself. Boldwood was seen through the smoke to be now again engaged with the gun. It was double-barreled, and he had meanwhile in some way fastened his handkerchief to the trigger and with his foot on the other end was in act of turning the second barrel upon himself. By chance, the bullet did not strike him. He was saved from the jaws of death. He ran to Bathsheba and kissed her. This scene is melodramatic, but in creating sensation, the novelist has also taken the advantage of integrating the plot. Every incident has been used to further the action of the novel. The melodramatic incident imparts dramatic effect to the novel. Apart from the three major incidents, there are also minor incidents and chances which add to the melodramatic atmosphere of the novel. About the minor incidents, Baker says, a string of further incidents, the fire among ricks, the storm that nearly destroys Bathsheba's harvest, and the poisoning of the sheep in the Clough field are fatalistic only in their accumulation, and not more decisive in their consequences than the valentine which in a childish freak she sends to Boldwood, one little mishap often to be utilized in other stories, Fanny Robin's mistake between All Saints and All Souls, and Sergeant Troy's indefinite postponement of their wedding falls into this category, whilst the sarcastic consent of the gargoyle pouring torrents of water on Fanny's grave and washing away the flowers planted by her penitent lover is another of those devilish incidents which Hardy relished.